We'll be back in the book of John today. We're in chapter number 18. And last week we stopped right in the middle of Jesus' night of trials. And as you may remember, that we had seen Peter deny Jesus three times, and at the end of it he went out and wept bitterly, finishing his downward slide here. We saw that it was a regression, I guess you could say, from his bold proclamations in the upper room to his denials there in the courtyard of the high priest. And then we saw where Annas had questioned Jesus about his doctrine and his disciples. We saw where Caiaphas had went through the process of trying to find some kind of fault, something that they could convict him over. See, they arrested him without even having a charge against him. And anyway, they couldn't even find false witnesses that would agree together, that would testify against him. And so they finally, I guess it was basically kangaroo court. And it seems like Jesus kind of got tired of putting up with it, and he finally just gives them what they want. And because he knew his hour was come, he knew he was going to the cross, and he's like, these guys can't even, you know, frame somebody properly. And so anyway, they ask him outright, are you the Messiah? Are you the Christ? And he admits that he is. And so they accuse him of blasphemy, say that he's guilty and should be killed. The high priest rips his garment, which it was against the law, against the Mosaic law, that the high priest wasn't supposed to do that. They start beating him and smiting him on the face and mocking him, ridiculing him, all kinds of things. And there's also another trial that John doesn't record. And it was all these things happened during the night. Okay, all that happened at night, which was not according to law. They did it all illegally. And so at daybreak, they met with the Sanhedrin to kind of have that final trial, that final sentence against him, because people were not supposed to be able to be convicted at night. The trials were not supposed to be carried out at night. So they meet at daybreak with the Sanhedrin to give the final conviction against him, the final sentence against him, just to give it some kind of semblance of legality. There was also not supposed to be a sentencing and an execution done on the same day. There was supposed to be at least a day in between. Obviously, they didn't carry that one out. But like I said, John didn't record that part of it. You can find it in the parallel accounts in the other Gospels. But today we're going to pick up with Jesus being brought before Pilate. So now it's after daybreak. The rooster has crowed. Peter has went off to weep. The religious leaders have already convicted him without really him doing anything whatsoever besides making the honest claim to be the Son of God, which he was. And so with that, they said he was guilty of blasphemy. And so now they have to get permission from the Gentile leaders, from Pilate and the Roman government. And Pilate was the Roman authority. He would have been similar to a governor, but he was Caesar's representative in the area. And so they have to bring Jesus before Pilate. Like I said, sun's up. It's early in the morning. And so they go to where Pilate is at. Now, Pilate normally would have been staying in Caesarea on the coast. He wouldn't have been in Jerusalem. Jerusalem was a landlocked city. It wasn't necessarily a beautiful haven like a coastal city would be. And for the most part, the Romans despised it. They didn't like Jerusalem. They didn't want to come to Jerusalem. They didn't want to be in Jerusalem unless they had to be. And so the palace of Pilate, of the ruler there, would have been in Caesarea. However, during the time of the Passover, there was a huge influx of Jews in Jerusalem. And so it was necessary that the presiding ruler over the area be there to keep peace, because the Jews weren't necessarily known for being peaceful people. They regularly were rebelling. They were regularly causing uproars and fusses, and they were honestly a pain in the rear end of anyone who tried to rule over them. And so with that, Pilate was in the area during that time, and he had a place that would have been kind of at the corner of the temple grounds here. And so he had that palace there that was the Antonia Fortress. that was built by, I believe it was Herod by his, or for his friend Mark Antony. Okay? And so the Antonio Fortress would have been on the temple grounds there. And so all this was going on. They took him, they arrested him, they went to the high priest, and now they're taking him to the Antonio Fortress to be tried before Pilate. They probably got Pilate out of bed, and he probably wasn't real fond of this whole circumstance. But anyway, Pilate was in the awkward position of trying to rule and represent Rome, but also trying to appease the difficult and rebellious Jews. He was there near the temple. There was a place for him to stay, but that wasn't where he normally resided. That was just where he stayed when he was in town. But they tried to stay out of Jerusalem the most they could because the Gentiles basically detested Jerusalem because that was the main city of the Jews. Obviously, the Jews didn't like the Romans, and the Romans didn't care much for the Jews. And so for them to be in Jerusalem, like I said, a landlocked city, wasn't, you know, a beautiful coastal city on the Mediterranean like Caesarea and different places were. So they went to the better places that were a lot better accessible, more pleasant visually. Because Jerusalem, honestly, it's not really that beautiful of a place. I mean, for years in Jerusalem, after it was laid waste and ruined and abandoned, nobody wanted Jerusalem. Nobody cared anything for Jerusalem until Israel's tried to start getting it back. You know, just like the big fight now over Palestine. And you've got the Palestinians versus the Jews. Nobody wanted that land until the Jews did. That was the thing. It's just like two little kids. You know, there can be a toy laying there for all day long, but as soon as someone picks it up, this one wants it too. And that's kind of how Jerusalem was. Nobody wanted it until the Jews had it. And there wasn't really anything to be all that thrilled with because I guess it's historic and different things, but it's not just an exceptional city. I mean, it's not. And so anyway, with all of this, Pilate didn't want to be in the middle of Jerusalem and in all that. But here's the thing. He had, like I said, the difficult position of trying to represent and rule from the Roman perspective, but he also had to try to keep peace with the Jews. Because this is basically what Rome had given him the charge of. They said, here, this is your territory, you rule it, you take care of it, and we don't want to hear anything from it. And so he was in this tightrope balancing act, trying to keep the Jews happy, but still trying to represent Rome. And like I said, the Jews were very difficult people. And so that was the thing. There was that whole thing of trying to appease them. We find several things as you look through the book of Acts where there's different cities, not always Jerusalem, but different cities within Israel or even in other regions around, Greek cities and things, that are ruled by Romans. And there's uproars, just like in Ephesus. Okay, and there's an uproar that comes. And they're trying to quiet everybody, trying to keep it down, because if there's too big of an uproar and it gets back to Rome, the guy who's presiding over it and supposed to be keeping the peace may lose his job. And so that's the thing, is they're trying to keep these happy and keep them happy, or they lose their job, or they may lose their head. Okay? And so this is the position that Pilate's in. That gives us a little bit of an understanding for the rest of the account and why he does what he does. And so anyway, like I said, it would have been a tightrope act for him. So we find in verse number 31, the reason that they brought him to Pilate. In verse 31 here, and we'll read down through this here in just a moment. But in, let me see here, verse 31, it says, "Then Pilate said unto them, Take ye and judge him according to your law. The Jews therefore say unto him, It is not lawful for us to put any man to death." And so that was the reason they brought him to Pilate, is because they couldn't execute someone. They wanted him to do it. And so other than fulfillment of prophecy, the Jews had a lot of liberty in ruling over different matters. They said, okay, you all just kind of, that was one of the best ways to keep them appeased, is give them a little bit of power, but keep a cap on it. Keep it limited. And so he said, okay, you all just kind of run your own nation, do your own thing according to your culture and your laws and stuff. And if you get into something difficult or something requiring death or great punishment, then you come to us. And so they had that liberty. And so that was given to the Sanhedrin. That was given to the religious body, or so-called religious body. And that's one reason it became so political. And so they had the power to rule over the people and do a lot of things. And the Romans just kind of said, hey, as long as you are getting along, I'm going to stay out of this. You see a lot of parents do that, right? You know, you got two kids, and as long as they're not killing each other, I'll just stay out of this, right? And then whenever it, you know, gets into a big uproar, then I've got to step in. That's how the Romans ruled Jerusalem. And so anyway, they had the liberty to govern in small matters, but to execute someone, Rome had to be involved. And that was the thing. I'll get a little bit ahead of myself, but one reason why Rome had protected, and this is what I believe anyway, one of the reasons why Rome had protected the ability to execute, for them to give the death penalty, and then rather than allowing the Jews or whatever one of their countries that they've conquered to actually be able to do that, is because it is the foundational premise of government. Okay? And we find as soon as Noah steps off the ark, this is the foundation of all civil government, is that God gives Noah the command that whoever sheds blood by man's hand, blood will be shed. Okay? And so he gives man the ability to punish criminals and offenders up to the point of death. That is the foundation, that's the cornerstone of civil government. Now that sounds a little bit goofy that, you know, the ability to execute criminals would be the foundation, but that's the thing, that's the most severe penalty, and God has given it to man. And with that, we see civil governments protect that. And that's what happened with Rome, is they protected that ability and said, we are the foundation of your government. We are the ones that are in charge. So you're not going to have that power. We're going to retain that for ourselves. And so the Jews weren't supposed to be able to execute anyone. And so let's start here in verse number 28 and read through the end of the chapter. And hopefully I can cover this fairly quickly, but you know how that goes. Says, then led they Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment, and it was early, and they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. Pilate then went out unto them, and said, what accusation bring ye against this man? They answered and said unto him, if he were not a malefactor, we would not have delivered him up unto thee. Then said Pilate unto them, take ye him, and judge him according to your law. The Jews therefore said unto him, it is not lawful for us to put any man to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, signifying what death he should die. Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again, and called Jesus, and said unto him, art thou the king of the Jews? Jesus answered him, sayest thou this thing of thyself, or did others tell it thee of me? Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done? Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence. Pilate therefore said unto him, art thou a king then? Jesus answered, thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. Pilate saith unto him, what is truth? And when he had said this, he went out again unto the Jews, and saith unto them, I find in him no fault at all. But ye have a custom that I should release unto you one at the Passover. Will ye therefore that I release unto you the king of the Jews? Then cried they all again, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. And so we've got Pilate dealing with him. John doesn't go real in depth with it. You find a lot more about this throughout the other accounts. You find that Pilate's wife actually cautions him. She has a dream, a vision, and she says, be very careful. Don't do anything to this just man. And there are several times where Pilate and his wife are very fearful in these things. They see that there's more to this than meets the eye. But anyway, in looking at verse number 28, they led him from Caiaphas, from the place there of the Sanhedrin and the high priest's house, led him to the hall of judgment. That would have been in the praetorium in the Antonia fortress, which is where the Roman government leaders would stay whenever they were in town. And so they led him there. But we find something kind of strange here, kind of funny, I guess you could say, that whenever they led him to this place, they wouldn't go in. They refused to go in, and it said that if they went into the judgment hall, they would be defiled and they wouldn't be able to eat the Passover. So we see their importance upon their religious rituals and ceremonies here. Okay? And keep in mind the timing of all of this, okay? Because this would have been the morning that the Jews killed the Passover lamb. And you can't make this up. I mean, honestly, God puts everything together perfectly. Man could not have orchestrated this. You know, hundreds of years prior to this, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of years prior to this, God puts into to beginning here, I guess, the Passover, whenever the Jews are leaving the land of Egypt. And the lamb is killed, the blood is put on the doorpost, all of these things, and the firstborn is not killed. So there is a death sentence upon the firstborn, but God provides a substitute. And that's what happened at the first Passover. And then every year they would celebrate this Passover as a memorial of God offering up a substitute for the one that was supposed to die. And it was all from the very beginning, it was a picture, it was an illustration. And God gives so many pictures to the Jews, even to us today, gives so many pictures of what he is doing. I know with my kids a lot of times, I'll tell them something, they just look at me kind of goofy and I say, you want me to draw a picture for you? Okay? God did that. I mean, time after time after time, and they were completely oblivious, completely missed it. They had been acting out this very day for centuries. And didn't realize it. Down to the exact timing, the exact events. Okay? And what was required in this Passover is that there had to be a lamb without spot and blemish. There had to be specific qualifications for this lamb. Okay? And there had to be a time that it was set aside, that it was observed, and that it had to be declared without fault or blemish. All these things happened to Christ. There was a time that he was in the public eye. He was observed. He was seen from all. And everybody that observed him said, we can find no fault in him. Even during the trial, they could find no fault. Even whenever he was before Annas and Caiaphas and all them, they could find no fault in him. They had to make it up. He came before Pilate. Pilate said multiple times, I find no fault in him. We can find about 7 different trials that Jesus went through. All of them, the verdict being, they couldn't find a fault. Okay? Pilate had him stand before him. He says, I find no fault. Tried to turn him loose. He heard that Herod was in town, and Herod was over the region of Galilee. This isn't mentioned in John, but we find it, I believe, in the book of Luke. And so Herod is over the region of Galilee, like Pilate is over Judea. Okay? And so he finds out that Jesus is from Galilee, and he says, hey, Herod's in town. I can pass the buck. And so he sends him off to Herod and says, okay, you try him. And Herod's excited about, you know, Jesus being here because he's heard about Jesus and he's hoping maybe Jesus will do some kind of trick or show for him. Okay, this is what he's hoping for. And so Herod observes him. I mean, he's rather snarky and cynical toward him, but he observes him. And at the end of it, he says, I can't find anything wrong with this guy. And he passes him back to Pilate. Pilate says, again, I find no fault in him. And no one can find any fault with him. And so on the very same day, about the same time they're killing the Passover lambs, they crucify Jesus. And they kill the lamb that taketh away the sins of the world. These were all things that were put out step by step. You, like I said, you couldn't make it up. You couldn't do this if you tried to fulfill this so perfectly. But God put it together step by step by step. And so anyway, it's just so amazing the way that this fulfills all this perfectly. But anyway, in verse number 28, what I was looking at there a moment ago, I got a little sidetracked maybe. But the religious leaders refused to go into Pilate's judgment hall. Now, there are several reasons that could be offered up for this. The main one being that they couldn't go into the residence of a Gentile, or they would be defiled. They would be unclean, and they wouldn't be able to partake of the Passover because they had to be ceremonially pure and clean. And so just being in Pilate's residence would have made them unclean. Being in a place of judgment, but of course I guess they were in the Sanhedrin, but where criminals had been punished, beaten, and those kind of things, they were staying clear of that. And so they were staying clean of all those, and they were giving the outward appearance of being so holy and so righteous. All the same time, they were trying to kill Jesus. I mean, this just shows you man's depravity, and it shows you the hypocrisy of religion. And so they didn't want to be ceremonially unclean and unable to keep the Passover, but yet they have the ultimate Passover lamb standing before them. They have the one that it all pointed to before them, and they were too dense to understand that, that they were fulfilling it perfectly. If you would have just substituted an animal for him, they did everything exactly as the Passover, except this time they had the Son of God instead of a sheep. And so anyway, another thing we see here is that Pilate humors them. Remember the tightrope act I was talking about? They refuse to go into the judgment hall. So now Pilate, the ruler over them, the one who's representing Rome, is having to go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth between them. And we see this constantly. If you follow through chapters 18 and 19, Pilate's in the judgment hall, out to the Jews, in the judgment hall, out to the Jews, into the judgment hall, out to the Jews, back and forth. He's like a puppet, but he's supposed to be the ruler. And so, as I was saying a minute ago, I find it quite interesting that they were so concerned about keeping the Passover, yet Jesus, the Lamb that takes away the sins of the world, was standing right before them. They were about to commit murder and didn't want to be unclean by going to the judgment hall. Okay? Remember how, I believe it was Jesus that told them that outwardly they had it all together. They were whited sepulchers. And that outwardly they looked beautiful. They had all of it together. They looked holy and righteous and all this. But inside they were full of dead men's bones. There was all kinds of extortion and excess and all these things that's put to them. John calls them a generation of vipers. And I think that's an apt description. And so anyway, they were keeping all of the outward appearances of being religious all the time while privately, secretly, they were plotting this man's death. Okay? Now, it may have seemed to be public, but they were putting on this facade that they were zealously religious, that this man is a blasphemer. He has lifted his voice against God. He has claimed to be God. And so we've got to keep ourselves religiously pure. We've got to protect the people. We've got to guard against these things. So we must execute this guy.
So it's okay for us to kill, but it's not okay for him to...
Yeah. It's okay for us to kill because we've got religious motive behind it. Because it's to protect the people from being misled by this blasphemer. And so this was their idea, even though everyone that came across him couldn't find any fault with him. Whenever his testimony around the area was that he goeth about doing good. Right? And so anyway, they tried their hardest to find any fault against him. They couldn't do it. And so it was pure and simple. It was murder. But yet they were going to be ceremonially pure taking up the Passover. And so I think it's a good lesson to us that we must be careful not to do the same thing as they do. Okay? Because we can get hung up on our pet preferences. We can get that critical, judgmental spirit toward other people, all the while we're still harboring our own sins. And it's the very heart of Phariseeism whenever other people's sins bother us more than our own do. That's where we have to be careful at. And it is so easy for us to get to that place where we can see everybody else's fault, we don't see our own. That's where there's a caution to first remove the beam out of your own eye before you take the mote out of others. Because the people who are the most critical of others are the ones that have the biggest problems themselves. I mean, it is. If you could honestly get it, and they may have the facade, they may have everything together, and they look good just like these guys from the outside. But God doesn't look on the outward appearances. God looks on the heart. And he sees the pride. He sees the jealousy that they had. He sees the animosity they had toward Jesus. He's seen the wrath and all of these things that they had inside of them. God sees it plainly. And so just because they thought they had the outward appearance altogether, they dressed right, talked right, smelled right, okay, that they had it all together, but yet all those other things they could suppress. It's amazing the sinfulness that we can keep inside and keep protected from everybody else. And that's what we have to be careful about. And that's one reason why I teach and preach so much about the Pharisees and things like that, because we can bash them all we want, but if we're not careful, we end up being like them. That's the thing. And what it is that if we're focused on the outward appearances, which is what religion does, if we're focused on the outward appearances and think as long as we can keep a mask over all of our faults and all of our failures and all of our sins, that we're okay as long as we put on a good show, that is wicked. That is sinful. That's not what God wants. He wants us to be real. And that's one thing I want to encourage and foster as a church family here, is that we don't have to put on facade. We don't have to cover up our deficiencies, but that we can stand before each other, flaws and all, and work to help one another, exhort one another through even all of those things. I don't want us to end up being like these guys. I don't. There's no reason why a church family, this is what we talked about last week, you know, looking at churches, it should be, we should be able to be real with one another. If we're struggling with something, it shouldn't be something, oh, I've got to hide that, I can't let that out. But this should be the place where we can confide in people. We can get encouraged. Here's the thing that I've seen in churches many, many times. There'll be an entire church, everybody's going through similar circumstances, but everybody's afraid to talk about it. Okay?
Yeah.
I've seen it at churches in the States, I've seen it at churches here. But everybody's having similar struggles and everything, but everybody says, I've got to keep a lid on this. I can't let anybody know I'm struggling, and that person's struggling, that person's struggling, that person's struggling. They can all band together and help one another, but everybody's afraid to have a chink in their armor.
Yeah.
Okay? And we can't be that way. That's not what it's supposed to be. We're supposed to bear one another's burdens. We're supposed to help one another. So anyway, we got that rabbit. We'll keep going here. And so anyway, they let their egregious sins that they fostered in their hearts, they had no problem with that because they had the outside looking okay. And so anyway, like I said, the Passover lamb stood before them and they were concerned with their rituals. God gave them this so that one day whenever the lamb stood before them, they could recognize and they were completely blinded. And so in verses 29 and 30, it says, Pilate then went out. See, here we go back and forth, the yo-yo back and forth between the judgment hall and the priests here. Pilate then went out unto them and said, What accusation bring ye against this man? They answered and said unto him, If he were not a malefactor, we would not have delivered him up unto thee. So Pilate went out to them, and I have no doubt he was not ignorant about Jesus. I mean, the things that Jesus did, the crowds that followed him, the multitudes, his teachings, his miracles, Pilate wasn't that dense. He had to know what was going on in his territory. He probably even knew about Jesus coming into town riding on a donkey a week earlier, but he probably dismissed it saying, what kind of king is that? Right? But anyway, he would have known about Jesus, but he didn't hear of anything. I mean, Jesus wasn't mounting insurrection. Jesus wasn't coming and raising up armies. Jesus wasn't doing anything wicked or evil. Nothing. He was going about doing good. He was healing people. He was teaching people to respect the government. He was teaching people to love God, to treat each other well. And Pilate comes out to the Pharisees here and he says, What charge do you have against this man? What is the accusation? And the religious leaders here seem almost indignant that he would even ask. Okay? And so, whenever he asks for this accusation, they seem indignant. They seem annoyed. And it's almost like they hope that he would just execute Jesus at their word without asking any questions. So it leads me to believe that maybe this was a normal practice, that in his efforts to appease the Jewish leaders and to keep from having any kind of uproar amongst them and keep on their good side there, and the fact that he didn't really care for the Jews, if they brought a Jew before him and said, hey, this guy has done things, he's deserving of death, sure, kill him. We can do it with a few less Jews. I can imagine, I'm not saying that myself, I'm saying as a Roman, okay? I can imagine him doing that. And, you know, they bring the normal guy in, he's fighting and cussing and fussing and all these kind of things. They say, yeah, he looks like he could be trouble. Go ahead and kill him. But this situation is a little bit different because they bring Jesus in and he doesn't see him being your average criminal. Because instead, he sees that Jesus is quiet. He's meek. He's a peasant. He's not riotous. He's not wrathful. He's not vengeful. He's not arrogant. But he comes in meek and very quiet and thinks he's not your normal criminal. He's not the normal one that the Jews would bring before him. And so he needs to hear the rest of the story. He says there's something smells a little fishy here. And so he asked the Jews, what is the accusation? And their simple response was, if he wasn't a malefactor, we wouldn't have brought him to you. And that word malefactor means an evildoer, a criminal. Okay? This isn't just someone who does a little bit of bad things. This is an extremely wicked, depraved person. And this is what they're accusing Jesus of being. If he wasn't this extremely wicked, evil, depraved person, we wouldn't have brought him to you if he wasn't a criminal. And I can kind of detect a little bit of sarcasm, a little disdain in their voice that, like I said, Pilate would even ask this. He says, we've got a reason for it. He deserves to be dead. You should respect us because we are the religious leaders. We are pure, right? We are clean. We would not bring someone to you unless they were an evildoer. How dare you question our integrity? I can imagine that being kind of the air that they bring with them. And so anyway, something doesn't line up because we see the Jews having the type of attitude that the criminal normally would. And we see the so-called criminal having the attitude that those who are in the right should have. Right? And so it seems to me that Pilate is confused by all of this. He sees, like I said, Jesus meek and he's just a peasant. Just a normal fellow there. But the religious leaders were the ones who are the evil ones. And so anyway, we see in verses 31 and 32 that Pilate tries to get out of the situation. Remember, I keep reminding of the tightrope act that he's doing. And so then Pilate said unto them, take ye him and judge him according to your law. The Jews therefore said unto him, it is not lawful for us to put any man to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, signifying what death he should die. So as he's trying to get out with get out of the situation, he tells them, you all go and deal with it. You go and judge him according to your law. Because he's looking at Jesus, he's seen plenty of insurrectionists. That's what they're accusing him of being. He's claiming to be the king of the Jews. He's claiming to be the one that has power over the Jews, the rightful heir. He is making threats against Rome. And here we've got the Roman official. He's making no threats against him. He's not haughty. He's not lifted up. He's not arrogant and prideful and boisterous as one in that position normally would be. And so anyway, he must not be that severe of a criminal. So he says, take him and judge him according to your own laws. And now we know that Pilate, like I said, wasn't stupid. He knew what they were trying to get him to do. So he's just kind of trying to dismiss it, but they wouldn't have it. And so I find it kind of funny at this time that the religious leaders have to admit Rome's authority. And one thing that we can't forget here is that the Jews always had a great disdain for Rome. They did not want to be ruled by Rome. In fact, in 70 AD, there's an uprising. That's whenever that's when Jerusalem is destroyed because they rise up and try to overthrow Rome. You know, you've got little old Israel there. You've got the entire Roman Empire, and they think that they can overthrow them. They think that they can throw their yoke off of them, so to speak. And so Rome just comes in and just levels their entire capital city and says that'll teach them. It didn't teach them because in about 120 AD, I believe it was 120, that once again, they rise up again against Rome. And that is whenever Rome completely destroys Israel. The entire nation takes them, scatters them everywhere, and Israel ceases to be as a country up until 1948, I believe it was.
When did that cease to be a country?
I believe it was 120. That was the final uprising. But it wasn't just those two times. It was constant. There was always some kind of uprising. That's why there was so much of a military presence and why Pilate was there during the Passover. They say, you get that many Jews together, there's going to be a fight. And this is what they were looking at. You know, you get all those Jews, they could have been hundreds of thousands of people in Jerusalem at that time. They've got an army. And so they've got to keep the peace in all of this. And so anyway, at this time, though, the religious leaders had to admit Rome's authority. They said, we don't have the authority to execute. We are limited. We have to come and bow before Rome to have you to do what we're wanting. But the whole time they're trying to work them like a puppet to get them to do what they wanted. You see how this goes? And so anyway, as I said earlier, Rome has guarded the ability to execute. And they had reserved it as their ability alone. But also it fulfills prophecy, which was predicted that the Messiah would die on a cross. And obviously the Jews did not execute with a cross. The Jews executed with stoning, right? That's how they did. They did it with stoning. But it was the Romans who killed by the cross. And so that was predicted a long time in advance before the Romans were even using a cross to execute. Before the Romans were even in power, before the cross had ever even been devised, the prophecy was put out there that he would be hung on a tree. Okay? And so if the Jews would have killed him, they would have done it by stoning. The prophecy wouldn't have been fulfilled. But God orchestrated everything to where the Romans would be in charge and their means of execution would be crucifixion. And so anyway, Jesus himself had said, whenever he was amongst his disciples, that he would be turned over to the Gentiles. And so all of these things fulfilled multiple prophecies. We can see also that there were probably other motives as well, because we see that Stephen was executed by the Jews. Stephen was executed by the Jews just a few years later. Come on in.
Sorry. He's shy.
But anyway, we can see that Stephen was executed by the Jews just a few years later, and he was executed by stoning. So why is it that they couldn't execute Jesus in the same way that they executed Stephen? Well, it wouldn't have fulfilled the prophecies. And so just some of the reasons why they may have sought out the Romans to execute Jesus would be to discredit his claims as the Messiah, because they were looking for a Messiah, being a militant leader. They were looking for a Messiah that would come and overthrow Rome. And so if Jesus was claiming to be the Messiah and Rome is the one that killed him, that just kind of adds insult to injury in that, in the Jews' way of thinking of things, right? Because, hey, he says he's going to be the Messiah and rule Israel, overthrow Rome, but the Romans are the ones that kill him. So that just kind of puts him out of there once and for all. The Jews get the final laugh and say he never was the Messiah or Rome wouldn't have killed him. And so that may have been one of the reasons why they desired so much to have Rome to kill him. Another reason would have been them trying to distance themselves because they had seen his power and his followers. They don't want to turn all of Israel against them. They're wanting to maintain their power and their position, being the leaders of Israel. And so if they can have the Romans to kill him, then that makes more animosity toward the Romans for those who follow Jesus, and they can kind of try to step back from it. Even though they orchestrated it all, it makes them look like they were okay, that they were clean of it, and they could tell their lies, they could do their little gymnastics with truth here to figure out some way to where they look like they were innocent of it, and that they wouldn't be the ones actually carrying out the death sentence to possibly be dealing with the power that Jesus had. Because Jesus had the power to raise people from the dead, right? He had the power to heal people, to do all these things, and they probably didn't want to come up against his power either. There would have been a little bit of a fear there. But also, I think maybe one of the last reasons why they wanted Rome to execute him was the fact that their law had in it that there was a curse on anyone who was killed upon a tree, whether it be by hanging or by crucifixion. Because we find in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 23, curses anyone who hangs on a tree. We find it again in Galatians 3 and 13 that we'll be looking at on either this Wednesday night or the next one. And we see this curse that was put upon them. So for the Jews, they knew their law. And they say, hey, what better way for this guy that we absolutely despise and hate to have him killed by the Romans and executed on a tree, bringing God's curse upon him? And so they put all these things together. And so in verse number 33, it says, "Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again," we see him back and forth, "and called Jesus and said unto him, Art thou the King of the Jews?" And so he confronted Jesus with their accusation, said, is he the King of the Jews? But you notice that the original charge, the original accusation against Jesus was blasphemy. But now the charge against him is insurrection against Rome. They had to change it around because they knew that Pilate didn't care a thing about blasphemy. He had blasphemed God himself. Right? And so if they would have brought Jesus and said, well, he blasphemed, Pilate would say, so what? Get him out of here. I don't care. However, if they brought him and said, hey, he's making threats against the Roman government, hey, we need to look into this. That carries some weight. And so anyway, they accused him of treason or sedition, basically, against Rome. And they would have taken that seriously. However, Pilate had seen his share of such characters. These guys were regularly rising up. There was ones that were constantly coming out, raising up little groups and saying, hey, let's go and overthrow the Romans. And they were, you know, going and killing different Roman officials and guards and assassinations and all this. Pilate would have been aware of these kind of things. He would have seen it regularly. But Jesus would have puzzled him because he's not, like I said before, the usual type. And here's another thing that would have been very puzzling to him. The Jews normally got behind these kind of figures. The Jews did not like Rome, did not want to be under Rome. So anyone who came and tried to rise up and rebel against Rome was a national hero. And so Pilate's like, wait a second. Why does it seem like they want to side with Rome now instead of someone who is trying to side against Rome? This doesn't make sense. And so Pilate would have been confused throughout this entire thing. I mean, anyone else would have come up and said, hey, let's go and liberate ourselves. Let's overthrow the Romans. Let's raise up an army. Let's do all of these things. They would have said, yeah, we're behind you. Jesus comes along and says that he's the Son of God, that he is the Messiah, but he doesn't proclaim himself to be the type of Messiah they wanted to be. They said, hold on here. You're not raising an army. You're not overthrowing Rome. You're not talking about liberating us. So we're going to kill you. There's the difference. And so Pilate's confused and he says, what in the world is going on here basically? And so they didn't embrace him. They didn't see him as they normally would have. And so it would have been nice to know the tone in which Pilate asked this question. That's one of the problems with things that are in writing, that you can't detect the tone. You can't see the sarcasm does not carry over in writing. I've learned that many times over. And
same as when you ask, what is truth?
Yes.
Like, we've had that preached to mm-hmm. us a few times, mm-hmm. saying how bad Pilate was. You know? Mm-hmm. And you're like,
I'll read it at a different tone, and I'll get into that in just a minute.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, as we see here, just imagine Pilate asking this with Jesus before him, looking like no king by any man's standard. You know, the Jews are saying, this man claims to be the King of the Jews. And Pilate's looking at him and he's like, he's dressed very modestly in just poor peasant's clothing. He's very meek. He's not anything. Because the Bible tells us plainly in several places that in his looks, he was just average. There was nothing to stand out. I mean, he wasn't like King Saul that stood head and shoulders above everyone. He wasn't like David that was ruddy and of a fair countenance. That was beautiful. Or Absalom, who had no flaw in him from head to toe. He was just an average Jew. And Pilate's looking at him and saying, I see nothing. And so Pilate asks him and says, are you the King of the Jews? That's kind of the tone I read into it. Are you claiming to be the king? Because you don't look like you're trying to be a king. You're not here in armor. You're not here in royal robes. You're not here in any of the normal things that we would assume a king to be. And so anyway, in verse number 34 there of John chapter 18, we find Jesus' answer here. It says, Jesus answered him, sayest thou this thing of thyself, or did others tell it thee of me? And some would read that in almost a sarcastic type of tone. I don't believe that Jesus was sarcastic, especially when dealing with somebody such as this. But Jesus is prodding Pilate to think. Pilate here, Jesus sees him in this balancing act. He sees him in this tightrope act. And I find him almost like the rich young ruler whenever he come to Jesus at night. It says that Jesus looked on him and he loved him. And he sees Pilate almost like a little boy trapped in between two things, just trying to get his way through things. And he's trying to provoke him to think. And Jesus is aware of all these things that's going on, and the Jews are running Pilate. And Jesus is trying to engage him, trying to get him to think for himself. He's saying, "Sayest thou this thing of thyself? Have you come to this conclusion on your own? Have you figured this out by yourself, or are you just doing what you're told?" And we find this in religion so many times as well, that people are just going through the motions, just doing what they were told, and they never think for themselves. And God desires that all men to consider Christ and decide for themselves. It's not something that can be forced on anyone. And like I said, I almost pity Pilate in this. I do. And it seems like Jesus was trying to engage in him, trying to get him to think here, trying to get him to consider, because he's just trying to feel his way through blindly. And he's like so many other people that I've ran into that they're just doing the best they know how, following the orders that they've been giving, and trying not to ask any questions and just doing what they have to do. And that's what religion tries to do. And we find time after time after time in scriptures that God is not that way. He's not the way that religion is. It's not blind following. It's not blind faith. But we see, even as we look through the book of Acts, whenever Paul went to different cities, it says that he reasoned with them. See, faith in Christ is a reasonable thing. God wants us to use our brains. He wants us to think for ourselves. He wants us to read and understand scriptures, and he wants us to put it to the test. Think it out. Don't just accept it because you were told. But he wants us to look at the scriptures and use our God-given brains to come to the conclusion, for us to consider him. In the book of Malachi, he says, "Try me." Right? It's something that we can put to the test, and he wants to be put to the test. Okay? Not just followed blindly. And so anyway, in verse number 34, he's engaging Pilate, and he's saying, "Did you come to this conclusion yourself, or are you just following blindly?" And so in verse 35, Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done?" And so Pilate kind of shrugs it off here, and he says, "I'm not a Jew. I don't care. I don't care about your ideas. I don't care about your kings. I don't care about their messiahship. I don't care about their religion. I don't care about any of these things. I'm not a Jew. This is a Jewish problem." And there's been many people that shrugged off and said, that's their religion. That's their ideas. That's their way of thinking, rather than looking for the truth. And that's one reason why Jesus confronts him with truth here in a little bit. It's not about being a Jew or a Gentile. It's about what is true and what's right. And so anyway, Pilate asked him, "Am I a Jew?" He's just kind of putting that question off there, saying, "It's not my problem." And then he brings the question. Like I said, he's confused through all of this. He says, "Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you unto me." And that last question, I think this is him honestly asking, "What have you done? What is it that they hate you so badly?" Because, like I said, normally they would have embraced someone who claimed to be their king. They were looking for anyone to be their king, anyone that could stand against Rome. But they didn't. Jesus, and he's Pilate saying, "What on earth did you do that made them bring you to me? What has turned them against you so badly? Because I see nothing." And so Jesus gives him an honest answer. I mean, here Jesus shoots completely straight with Pilate. And I like this exchange between him and Pilate, because whenever he was dealing with the religious leaders, whenever he was dealing with Caiaphas and Annas, he wasn't dealing with them in this same tone. We see that Jesus speaks differently to different people. Okay? It's based on the receptiveness and who they're actually talking to. The Jews have already decided they hate him. They want to kill him. Pilate and Annas both said, "He's going to die. We just have to figure out how to do it." But Pilate here, on the other hand, I don't know if I said Pilate a minute ago, Caiaphas and Annas. But Pilate here, on the other hand, he doesn't know what's going on, and he's trying to get to the bottom of it. He's actually looking for answers. And so in verse 36, Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, that I should not be delivered unto the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence." And so this is Jesus' answer. He gives him this direct answer. He is not a king after the world's sense. Why do the Jews hate him? Why are they rejecting him? Why are they not embracing him as their king? Because he's not the kind of king they were looking for. That's the reason. He says that my kingdom is not of this world. It's not formed the way that the Jews expected. It's not by worldly means. They are looking for a worldly leader that leads by human philosophy and human reasoning. That's what they're looking for. And he says, my kingdom is not of the world. It's not the way the world does things. It's not a king in the world sense. He wasn't coming with powerful armies and conquering their enemies. That's what they were looking for. And that's why he is rejected. He's no threat to Rome. He's a threat to religion. That is why they're rejecting him. That is what he has done. He's not a threat to Rome in any sense. He's not coming to rise against Rome. He's coming to rise against religion. That is the heart of it. That is why they hate him. His kingdom is spiritual, not civil. He says here clearly that if his kingdom would have been of the world, if it would have been after the world system and the world's format here, they would have already come and fought and delivered him. But he says that's not the way I'm doing things. And so that is why he is disdained by them. And so since he mentioned kingdom in verse 37, Pilate therefore said unto him, "Art thou a king then?" He says, "My kingdom's not of this world." So he's saying, "I have a kingdom." And so Pilate says, "Okay, you said you have a kingdom. Does that make you a king? Are you a king then?" Pilate's sorting this out. And so Jesus' answer to them is, "Thou sayest that I am a king." Well, I guess by the world sense, you could call me a king. That's what the world, the title they would put on it. But he's not a king. He is God. He is the Lord of Lords. He is the King of all kings. And so in a worldly sense, he says, thou sayest that I'm a king. You call me a king. You know, you might put that title on me, but God operates outside of worldly titles. He's God. He's not just merely a king after a world sense of it. They think of a king of being a small king of a kingdom over here and a king over here. He says, no, I'm the king of the world, basically. And not after the world sense. And so he says, thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. And so he says, you can call me a king, but I'm not operating as a king. He says, this is the reason I came into the world. This is the battle that I've come to fight. He says, I'm not coming to fight with armies and horses and conquering and against the Romans. He says, I'm coming with a different battle in mind. I'm not coming to rule over an earthly kingdom and have a physical throne. He says, I'm coming to regain what Adam lost, basically, here. Adam gave up the rights to the entire world. Jesus is coming back to get it back. And so anyway, like I said, he's more than a king. He's doing what he came for. He was showing truth to anyone who would listen. He was the embodiment of truth. It was more than just a kingship. It was more than just a position. He was the truth. And that sparks the question that we were mentioning there earlier. Verse 38, Pilate saith unto him, what is truth? Pilate asks him, he says, what is truth? But he never waits for the answer. Truth is standing before him. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. You want to know truth? It's standing before you. Pilate says, what is truth? Doesn't wait for the answer. Rejects it whenever it stands right before him. It's a sad statement there. But as far as Pilate's tone in this, as I read through this conversation between Jesus and Pilate, I believe it is one of cynicism, in a sense, that Pilate, honestly, he has been trapped. He's looking at all this around him. He's looking at his perspective as a Roman with their plethora of gods. He's looking at the Jews with their deceit and their lies, and he knows he's being lied to. He's looking at the world, and he can't find any truth. Everything is abstract. Everything is opinion. And in the world that he lived in that time, it wasn't a matter of right and wrong. It wasn't a matter of truth. It was power. It was opinions. It was all of these different things. And honestly, I think Pilate says this almost in desperation. He says, I've lived all this time. I've been around all these things. I've climbed the ladder, so to speak, in power here. And he said, what is truth? They had their philosophers at the time. Man was trying to guess and trying to figure it out. But outside of God and outside of His truth, there is no truth. That's how we get into moral relativity that we have today. That man doesn't know right and wrong. They can't figure out what's right and wrong. They don't know because there is no truth. They've abandoned God. And so Pilate's looking around almost in desperation. He's forlorn looking around. He's like, what is truth? You come and you say you're coming for the truth. You're showing people the truth. And I've seen all the lies. I've seen all the different opinions. He says, I'm so confused. I don't even know what truth is. Forget it. I'm out of here. And he turns around. He goes back to the Jews here. And it says, and when he had said this, he went out again unto the Jews and saith unto them, I find in him no fault at all. So I find no fault in him. This is another time that he has said this, but he says, I've talked with him and I've never spoke to anyone like him that spoke the way that he did. But I definitely haven't found any fault in him. And so he makes his last ditch effort, so to speak here. Like I said, he sends him off to Herod in between all this. But he makes a last ditch effort here to get Jesus off the hook. In verse number 39 and 40, he says, but ye have a custom that I should release unto you one at the Passover. Will ye therefore that I release unto you the King of the Jews? Then cried they all again, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. And this is extremely interesting part here. Because they have a tradition. They have a tradition that at the Passover, remember I said that the whole purpose of the Passover was a substitute, was the innocent lamb dying for the one who was sentenced to death in Egypt. Okay? And so the Jews had came up, this wasn't something of God, the Jews had come up with their own tradition, and so they would pardon a criminal at the Passover. And so Pilate said, okay, you have this tradition. You pardon a criminal at the Passover. How about we pardon Jesus? I find no fault in him, but you say he does wrong. So instead of executing him, what you want to do, instead of completely absolving him of all guilt like I want to do, how about we make a compromise and we call him guilty but let him off the hook? And Pilate says, you know, everybody wins. You don't have to say that he's innocent. I don't have to kill him. Everybody wins. We just let him go. And so he asked them this, and he says, should I release unto you the King of the Jews? And I wonder if calling him the King of the Jews, if he misread the crowd or if he thought it would help here. Okay? Because they come and they said, he claims to be the King of the Jews. Normally, if he said the King of the Jews, they'd say, oh yeah, we want a king, release him to us. And it would gain favor. I don't know if he misread the crowd there or if he was being antagonistic toward them. And just did something really stupid here. If he was trying to get Jesus off and said, hey, should I release your king? And he said, hey, he's not our king. They actually say in one of the other accounts, we have no king but Caesar. All along they're wanting to overthrow Rome, and then all of a sudden they claim Caesar as being their king. It's crazy in all this. But anyway, he may have called him king thinking that it would help, but he just completely misread it. But anyway, the Bible's amazing in this account. If you put all four of the Gospels together, all four of them tell of Barabbas. You know, as you look through the Gospels, each one of them tell different things, and most things within the Gospels aren't recorded in all four of them unless it's extremely important. Barabbas is recorded in all four of them. Okay? We find that he was a thief, he was a murderer, he was a rebel. It says that he tried to mount insurrection against Rome. Basically, Barabbas was the kind of man that the Jews were looking for. We often look at Barabbas and think, how in the world could they desire a murderer and a thief over Jesus? Well, the thing is, he committed insurrection. That's when the murder happened. He was trying to overthrow Rome. That's what they were wanting Jesus to do. So Pilate offers up Barabbas or Jesus, the kind of king you wanted or the kind of king that God has for you. You take the pick. You choose. And this is what's being offered up here. This is what all men have been offered all throughout history, your way or God's way. This is the choice that's given before them. And so Jesus was completely innocent, had been pronounced innocent multiple times. Barabbas was clearly guilty. And so as he's revolted against Rome, that's what, like I said, the Jews desired in a Messiah. Someone who would angrily rise up and lead the charge against the Romans. That was Barabbas. He had done what they are accusing Jesus of. Okay? He was guilty of the exact same thing they're accusing Jesus of. You see the parallels here. They chose man's failed way over God's way one more time. That's what man does constantly. My way over God's way. My way is going to work better. But the amazing part is the illustrations painted by the event. On the Passover, like I said, the feast that commemorated the lambs dying as substitutes for the firstborn in Egypt, Jesus would die as a substitute for the world. Barabbas is a representative of mankind that Christ died for, a thieving, murdering rebel, and Jesus took his place. Okay? Barabbas deserved death. Jesus took his place, and no one there could see at that time, but in reality, we're all Barabbas. We are. We're all Barabbas. Barabbas did the very same things that Jesus died for. Jesus took Barabbas' place. That cross that Jesus died on was meant for Barabbas. The crimes that Barabbas did was applied to Jesus and put upon him, and he died in Barabbas' place. It was an exact picture of what Jesus has done for us. He was made sin that we could be made righteous and holy and just. He took our sins upon himself. All these things played out in all this. And it's just amazing because, like I've said several times this morning, there's no way that we could put this together. There's no way that man could put this together. But God orchestrated it all the way down to Barabbas. Every bit of it. So, does anyone have any questions or comments on this section of Scripture? We went a little long, but we got started late too. So, okay. Well, if there's no questions or comments, let's go ahead and pray, and we'll be dismissed and take a short break. Dear Lord, we come to you once again today. Thank you for your many blessings. Lord, we thank you for this passage of Scripture that we've examined this morning and for the truth that's taught in it. Lord, just help us to grow from this. Help us to learn of your love for us. Help us to learn of your ability to orchestrate everything, put things together perfectly as you do so often. Lord, I just pray that you be with our time together, be with this next service, Lord. Have your will and your way in it. Guide us as we preach your word. Thank you so much for all you do. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.